were meat-eating theropods like Dilophosaurus, with a weird double mohawk crest on its skull. At around 20 feet long, it was much larger than the mule-size Coelophysis and most other Triassic carnivores. Plant-eating ornithischians covered in armor plates like Scelidosaurus and Scitellosaurus would soon after give rise to the familiar tank-like ankylosaurs and back-plated stegosaurs. Small, fast-moving, probably omnivorous ornithischians like Heterodontosaurus and Lesotosaurus were early members of that lineage that would eventually produce the horned and duck-billed dinosaurs. Other familiar dinosaurs that had been around in the Triassic but restricted to only a few environments, like the long-necked protosauropods and the most primitive ornithischians, finally began to migrate around the planet. Nothing in this inventory of growing diversity encapsulates the newfound dominance of dinosaurs quite like the sauropods. They are those unmistakable, long-necked, column-limbed, pot-bellied, plant-devouring, small-brained behemoths. Some of the most famous dinosaurs of all are sauropods. Brontosaurus, Brachiosaurus, Diplodocus. They show up in almost all museum exhibits and are stars of Jurassic Park. Fred Flintstone used one to mine slate, and a green cartoon sauropod has been the logo of Standard Oil for decades. Along with T-Rex, they are the iconic dinosaurs. Sauropods evolved from an ancestral stock, what I've been calling the proto-sauropods, in the latest Triassic. These proto-species were the dog-to-giraffe-sized plant-eaters with fairly long necks that were among the first wave of dinosaurs to appear in Ishigulasto about 230 million years ago. They then became the main herbivores in the humid parts of Triassic Pangaea, but were kept from achieving their full potential by their inability to settle the deserts. That changed in the early part of the Jurassic, when sauropods were able to break free of their environmental restrictions and move about the globe, evolving their characteristic noodle-necked bodies and growing to monstrous sizes in the process. Fossils of some of the first truly gigantic sauropods, ones that weighed over 10 tons, were over 50 feet long, and had necks that could stretch several stories into the sky, have started turning up in Scotland over the past few decades, on a beautiful island off the west coast called the Isle of Skye. The clues have been meager. A stocky limb bone here, a tooth or a tail vertebra there. But they hint at an animal of enormous size living about 170 million years ago, far enough into the Jurassic that the Pangaean split and volcanic apocalypse were distant memories, but still during that time when dinosaurs were putting the final flourishes on their rise to dominance. The sauropod fossils from Skye piqued my interest when I moved to Scotland in 2013 to take up my new position at the University of Edinburgh, fresh out of my PhD in New York and bounding with the excitement of starting my own research lab. During my first few weeks on the job, I began to hang out with two scientists in my department. Mark Wilkinson, a hardened field geologist whose ponytail and scruffy beard give him the look of a hippie, and Tom Challens, a red-headed packhorse of a man who also had a doctorate in paleontology, albeit on microscopic fossils from over 400 million years ago. Tom had recently finished a stint in the real world, putting his geological skills to use working for an energy company on the search for oil. For part of that time, he lived in a custom-made camper van, fitted with a bed and small kitchen, which he would park near whatever sites he was surveying. His new bride put the kibosh on that lifestyle after their wedding, but the van still came in handy for fieldwork travel, and Tom would often spend his weekends driving along the misty coasts of Scotland, looking for whatever fossils he could find. Both Tom and Mark had done some geological work on Skye and knew the terrain well, so we made a pact to hunt for better fossils of the mysterious giant sauropods. The more we read about Skye, the more one name kept popping up. Dugald Ross. It wasn't a name I was familiar with. He wasn't a paleontologist or a geologist or a scientist of any kind. Yet he had discovered and described many of the dinosaur fossils found on Skye. Dugald was a local boy who grew up in the tiny hamlet of Ellishotter on the far northeastern arm of the island, a rugged landscape of craggy peaks, green hills, peat-colored streams, and windswept shores that looked like something out of a fantasy novel. Very Tolkien-esque. He was raised in a household that spoke Gaelic, the native language of the Scottish Highlands, which is spoken by only about 50,000 people today, but which still has a presence on the road signs and in the schools on remote islands like Skye. When Dugald was 15 years old, he found a cache of arrow points and Bronze Age artifacts near his family's home, and this sparked an obsession with the history of his native island that continued into his adulthood, as he carved out a career as a builder and crofter, a Scottish Highlands term for a small-scale farmer and sheepherder. I got in touch with Dugald and told him about our dreams of finding huge dinosaurs on his island. It was one of the most fortunate emails I've ever sent, because it struck up a friendship and a remarkable scientific collaboration. Dugald, or Doogie as he prefers to be called, invited us to visit him when we came up to his island a few months later. He instructed us to drive up the main two-lane road that snakes along the coast of northeastern Skye and meet him at a long ranch-style building made up of a collage of different-sized gray stones and a black tile roof, with antique farming instruments strewn across the lawn outside. There was a sign out front that said Titaskia, the Gaelic word for museum. Doogie emerged from his big red work van with a set of oversized skeleton keys, made his introductions, and proudly led us inside. In his soft-spoken lyrical accent, a charming combination of Sean Connery-style Scots and an Irish brogue, he explained how he had taken the ruins of a one-room schoolhouse and built the structure we were standing in, the Staffan Museum. He founded the museum when he was 19. Today, this single room, without a cafe, a big gift shop, or other expensive trappings of big city museums, or even electricity, contains many of the dinosaurs he's found on Skye, along with artifacts that trace the history of the island's human inhabitants. It's a surreal experience. Big dinosaur bones and footprints displayed next to old mill wheels, iron rods for picking turnips, and antique mole traps once used by Highland farmers. For the rest of that week, Doogie led us to many of his favorite hunting spots. We found a lot of Jurassic fossils. The jaw of a dog-sized crocodile, the teeth and backbones of reptiles called ichthyosaurs, which resembled dolphins and lived in the oceans when dinosaurs started to dominate the land, but no giant sauropods. Over the next few years, we kept coming back. Finally, in the spring of 2015, we found what we set out for, although we didn't even realize it at first. We spent most of the day on our hands and knees, looking for tiny fish teeth and scales embedded in a platform of Jurassic rocks that stretched into the icy waters of the North Atlantic, right below the ruins of a 14th century castle. This was Tom's idea. He now studies fossil fish, and in exchange for his help finding dinosaurs, I promised to assist him in collecting fishy bits. We had been squinting at the rocks for hours, bundled up in three layers of waterproof clothing, but still freezing. The tide was coming in, the late afternoon light was going down, and dinner was beckoning. So Tom and I packed up our gear and our bags of fish teeth and started to stroll back to his tricked-out van parked on the other side of the beach. That's when something caught our eyes. It was a malformed depression in the rock, about the size of a car tire. We had missed it earlier because our eyes were focused on the much smaller fish bones, our search image totally unsuitable for noticing something so big. As we continued to walk, we started to notice many other similar depressions, now visible in the low-angle afternoon light. They were all about the same size, and the closer we looked, the more we saw that they stretched in every direction around us. They seemed to show a pattern. Individual holes were lined up in two long rows in something of a zigzag arrangement. Left, right, left, right, left, right. Ribbons of them were crisscrossing much of the rock platform that we had been working on all day. Tom and I looked at each other. It was the kind of knowing glance between brothers, a nonverbal connection based on years of shared experience. We had seen these types of things before, not in Scotland, but in places like Spain and Western North America. We knew what they were. The holes in front of us were fossilized tracks, huge ones. Dinosaur tracks, no doubt. As we looked closer, we could see that there were both handprints and footprints, and some of them had finger and toe marks. They had the telltale shape of tracks left by sauropods. We had found a 170-million-year-old dinosaur dance floor, records left by colossal sauropods that were about 50 feet long and weighed as much as 3 elephants. The tracks were made in an ancient lagoon, an environment not commonly associated with sauropods. We usually envisioned these monstrous dinosaurs stampeding across the land, causing a small earthquake with each step. And they did. But by the middle part of the Jurassic, the sauropods had become so diverse that they started branching out into other ecosystems, always searching for the vast quantities of leafy food needed to fuel their giant bodies. Our trackway site in Skye has at least 3 different layers of footprints made by different generations of sauropods wading through a salty lagoon, living with smaller plant-eating dinosaurs, the occasional pickup truck-sized carnivore, and many types of crocodiles, lizards, and swimming mammals with flat tails like beavers. Scotland was much warmer back then, a land of swamps and sandy beaches and rolling rivers on an island in the middle of the growing Atlantic Ocean, perched between North American and European land masses that moved farther and farther apart as Pangaea continued to split. Thoroughly ruling this land were the sauropods and other dinosaurs, which had now finally become a global phenomenon. There's really no better way to say it. The sauropods that made their marks in that ancient Scottish lagoon were awesome creatures. Awesome in the literal sense of the word. Impressive, daunting, inspiring awe. If I was handed a blank sheet of paper and a pen and told to create a mythical beast, my imagination could never match what evolution created in sauropods. But they were real. They were born, they grew, they moved and ate and breathed, they hid from predators, they slept, they left footprints, they died. And there's absolutely nothing like sauropods around today. No animals with similar long-necked and swollen gut body type. No creatures on land that even remotely approach them in size. Sauropods are so mind-twistingly big that, when their first fossil bones were discovered in the 1820s, scientists found themselves in a bind. Some of the first dinosaurs were being found around the same time, like the meat-eating Megalosaurus and the beaked herbivore Iguanodon. These were big animals, no doubt, but nowhere near the size of the creatures that left the gigantic sauropod bones. So scientists didn't make the connection with dinosaurs. Instead, they considered the sauropod bones to belong to the one type of thing they knew could get so huge. Whales. It was a few decades before that mistake was corrected. Amazingly, later discoveries would show that many sauropods got even bigger than most whales. They were the largest animals that ever walked the land, and they pushed the limit for what evolution can achieve. This raises a question that has fascinated paleontologists for over a century. How did sauropods become so large? It's one of the great puzzles of paleontology. But before trying to solve it, we first need to come to grips with a more fundamental issue. How big did sauropods get? How long were they? How high could they stretch their necks? And most important, how much did they weigh? These turn out to be difficult questions to answer, particularly when it comes to weight, because you can't just stick a dinosaur on a scale and weigh it. A trade secret among paleontologists is that many of the fantastical numbers you see in books and museum exhibits, Brontosaurus weighed 100 tons and was bigger than a plane, are pretty much just made up. Educated guesses, or in some cases, barely that. Recently, however, paleontologists have come up with two different approaches to more accurately predict the weight of a dinosaur based on its fossil bones. The first is really quite simple and relies on basic physics. Heavier animals require stronger limb bones to support their weight. This logical principle is reflected in how animals are built. Scientists have measured the limb bones of many living animals, and it turns out that the thickness of the main bone in each limb that supports the animal, the femur, thigh bone for those that walk on two legs only, or the femur plus the humerus, upper arm bone, for those that stand on all fours, is strongly statistically correlated with the weight of the animal. In other words, there is a basic equation that works for almost all living animals. If you can measure limb bone thickness, you can then calculate body weight with a small but recognized margin of error. Simple algebra you can do with a basic calculator. The second method is more intensive, but a lot more interesting. Scientists are starting to build three-dimensional digital models of dinosaur skeletons, add on the skin and muscles and internal organs in animation software, and use computer programs to calculate body weight. It's a method pioneered by a number of young British paleontologists, Carl Bates, Charlotte Brassey, Peter Falkingham, and Susie Maidment, and their network of collaborators, who include everyone from biologists specializing in living animals to computer scientists and programmers. A few years ago, when I was finishing my PhD, Carl and Peter invited me to take part in a study of sauropod body size and proportions using digital models. It was an ambitious goal: make detailed computer animations of all sauropods with complete enough skeletons and figure out how big these animals were and how their bodies changed as they grew into truly titanic sizes. I was invited for purely practical reasons. Some of the best sauropod skeletons in the world are on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, where I was based at the time. And they needed data for one of them in particular, a late Jurassic species called Barosaurus. They instructed me how to gather the information to build the model, and I was surprised that all it required was a normal digital camera, a tripod, and a scale bar. I took about 100 photos of the Barosaurus skeletal mount from all possible angles, keeping my camera steady on the tripod and making sure to include a ruler in most of the images. Then Carl and Peter input the images into a computer program that matches equivalent points on the photograph, works out the distances between them based on the scale, and does this continuously until a three-dimensional model is built from the original 2D images. The technique is called photogrammetry, and it's revolutionizing how we study dinosaurs. The super-accurate models it creates can be measured in precise detail, or they can be loaded into animation software and made to run and jump in order to determine what kinds of motions and behaviors dinosaurs were capable of. They can even be used to animate movies or television documentaries, ensuring that the most realistic dinosaurs appear on screen. These models are bringing dinosaurs to life. Our computer modeling study and more traditional studies based on limb bone measurements come to the same conclusion. Sauropod dinosaurs were really, really big. The primitive protosauropods like Plateosaurus began to experiment with relatively large sizes in the Triassic, as some of them got up to about 2 or 3 tons in weight. That's roughly equivalent to a giraffe or two. But after Pangaea started to split, the volcanoes erupted, and the Triassic turned into the Jurassic, the true sauropods got much larger. The ones that left tracks in the Scottish Lagoon weighed about 10 to 20 tons, and later in the Jurassic, famous beasties like Brontosaurus and Brachiosaurus expanded to more than 30 tons. But that was nothing compared to some supersized Cretaceous species like Dreadnoughtus, Patagotitan, Argentinosaurus, members of an aptly named subgroup called the Titanosaurs, which weighed in excess of 50 tons, more than a Boeing 737. The biggest and heaviest land animals today are elephants. Their sizes vary depending on where they live and which species they belong to, but most weigh about 5 or 6 tons. Apparently, the largest one ever recorded was around 11 tons. They have nothing on sauropods. Which circles back to the money question. How were these dinosaurs able to attain sizes so completely out of scale with anything else evolution has ever produced? The first thing to consider is what animals require to become really big. Perhaps most obvious, they need to eat a lot of food. Based on their sizes and the nutritional quality of the most common Jurassic foodstuffs, it's estimated that a big sauropod like Brontosaurus probably needed to eat around 100 pounds of leaves, stems, and twigs every day. Maybe more. So they needed a way to gather and digest such vast quantities of grub. Secondly, they need to grow fast. Growing bit by bit, year by year, is all well and good, but if it takes you over a century to get big, that's many opportunities for a predator to eat you, or a tree to fall on you during a storm, or a disease to take you out long before you grow into your full-size adult body. Third, they must be able to breathe very efficiently so they can take in enough oxygen to power all of the metabolic reactions in their immense bodies. Fourth, they need to be constructed in a way that their skeleton is strong and sturdy, but also not so bulky that it can't move. Finally, they need to shed excess body heat, because in hot weather it is very easy for a big creature to overheat and die. Sauropods must have been able to do all of these things. But how? Many scientists who started to ponder this riddle decades ago went for the easiest answer. Maybe there was something different in the physical environment back in the Triassic, Jurassic, and Cretaceous. Perhaps gravity was weaker, so heftier animals could move and grow more easily back then. Or maybe there was more oxygen in the atmosphere, so the hulking sauropods could breathe and therefore grow and metabolize more efficiently. These speculations might sound convincing, but on closer scrutiny they don't check out. There is no evidence gravity was substantially different during the age of dinosaurs, and oxygen levels back then were about the same as today, or maybe even slightly lower. That leaves only one plausible explanation. There was something intrinsic about sauropods that allowed them to break the shackles that constrained all other land animals, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, even other dinosaurs, to much smaller sizes. The key seems to be their unique body plan, which is a mixture of features that evolved piecemeal during the Triassic and earliest Jurassic, culminating in an animal perfectly adapted for thriving at large size. It all starts with the neck. The long, spindly, slinky-shaped neck is probably the single most distinctive feature of sauropods. A longer-than-normal neck started to evolve in the very oldest Triassic proto-sauropods, and it got proportionally longer over time as sauropods both added more vertebrae, the individual bones in the neck, and stretched each individual vertebra ever further. Like Iron Man's armor, the long necks conferred a kind of superpower. They allowed sauropods to reach higher in the trees than other plant-eating animals, giving them access to a whole new source of food. They could also park themselves in one area for several hours and extend their necks up and down and all around like a cherry picker, gobbling up plants while expending very little energy. That meant they were able to eat more food and thus take in energy more efficiently than their competitors. That's adaptive advantage number one. Their necks permitted them to eat the huge meals necessary to put on excessive weight. Then there's the way that they grew. Recall that the dinosauromorph ancestors of dinosaurs developed higher metabolisms, faster growth rates, and a more active lifestyle than many of the amphibians and reptiles that were also diversifying in the earliest Triassic. They weren't lethargic, and it didn't take them eons to grow into adults like an iguana or a crocodile. This was also true of all their dinosaur descendants. Studies of bone growth indicate that most sauropods matured from guinea pig-sized hatchlings to airplane-sized adults in only about 30 or 40 years, an incredibly short period of time for such a remarkable metamorphosis. That's advantage two. Sauropods obtained the fast growth essential to reach large size from their distant cat-sized ancestors. Sauropods also retained something else from their Triassic ancestors, a highly efficient lung. The lungs of sauropods were very similar to those of birds and very different from ours. While mammals have a simple lung that breathes in oxygen and exhales carbon dioxide in a cycle, birds have what is called a unidirectional lung. Air flows across it in one direction only, and oxygen is extracted during both inhalation and exhalation. The bird-style lung is extra efficient, sucking up oxygen with each breath in and each exhalation. It's an astounding feature of biological engineering, made possible by a series of balloon-like air sacs connected to the lung, which store some of the oxygen-rich air taken in during inhalation so that it can be passed across the lung during exhalation. Don't worry if it sounds confusing. It is such a strange lung that it took biologists many decades to figure out how it works. We know that sauropods had such a bird-like lung because many bones of the chest cavity have big openings called pneumatic fenestrae, where the air sacs extended deep inside. They are exactly the same structures in modern birds, and they can only be made by air sacs. So that's adaptation three. Sauropods had ultra-efficient lungs that could take in enough oxygen to stoke their metabolism at huge size. Theropod dinosaurs had the same bird-style lungs, which could have been one factor that allowed tyrannosaurs and other giant hunters to get so large. But the Ornithischian dinosaurs did not. This is why duck-billed dinosaurs, stegosaurs, horned species, and armored dinosaurs were never able to grow as huge as sauropods. It turns out that air sacs also have another function. Aside from storing air in the breathing cycle, they also lighten the skeleton when they invade bone. In effect, they hollow out the bone so that it still has a strong outer shell but is much more lightweight, the way an air-filled basketball is lighter than a rock of similar size. Want to know how sauropods could hold up their long necks without toppling over like an unbalanced seesaw? It's because all of the vertebrae were so engulfed by air sacs that they were little more than honeycombs, featherweight but still strong. And that's advantage four. The air sacs allowed sauropods to have a skeleton that was both sturdy and light enough to move around. Without air sacs, mammals, lizards, and Ornithischian dinosaurs had no such luck. And what about the fifth special adaptation, being able to expel excess body heat? The lungs and air sacs helped with this, too. There were so many air sacs, and they extended throughout so much of the body, snaking their way into bones and between internal organs, that they provided a large surface area for dissipating heat. Each hot breath would be cooled by this central air conditioning system. Putting it all together, that's how you can build a supergiant dinosaur. If sauropods had lacked any one of these features, the long neck, the fast growth rates, the efficient lung, the system of skeleton lightening and body cooling air sacs, then they probably would not have been capable of becoming such behemoths. It wouldn't have been biologically possible. But evolution assembled all of the pieces, put them together in the right order, and when the kit was finally assembled in the post-volcanic world of the Jurassic, sauropods suddenly found themselves able to do something no other animals before or since have been able to do. They became biblically huge and swept around the world. They became dominant in the most magnificent way, and they would remain so for another 100 million years. 4. Dinosaurs and drifting continents. Nestled within the leafy streets of New Haven, Connecticut, on the northern fringes of the Yale University campus, there is a shrine. I've visited a few times, and it moves me in nearly a spiritual way. It's not a normal shrine, no statues of deities, flickering candles, or the hint of incense. It's also not particularly magnificent, at least from the outside, tucked away inside a fairly nondescript brick building that blends in with the rest of the university's lecture halls. But it houses relics that, to me, are as sacred as those you'll find in most any religious shrine. Dinosaurs. Okay, so the Great Hall of Dinosaurs at Yale's Peabody Museum may not bill itself as a place of spiritual pilgrimage, but that's sure what it feels like to me. I get a shiver, as when I walked into Catholic Mass as a child. To me, there is nowhere better, anywhere on the planet, to go and immerse yourself in the wonder of the prehistoric world. The Great Hall was originally built in the 1920s to house Yale's incomparable dinosaur collection, assembled over many decades by roughnecks who fanned across the American West and, for the right fee, sent fossil treasures eastward to be studied by the Ivy League elite. Coming up on its centennial, the gallery retains all of its original charm. This isn't some new-age exhibit space with flashing computer screens and dinosaur holograms and a roaring soundtrack in the background. It's a temple of science, where skeletons of some of the most iconic dinosaurs stand in solemn vigil, lights down low, in the sort of silence you really do expect in a church. Covering the entire east wall is a mural that stretches more than 100 feet long and 16 feet high. Taking 4.5 years to complete, it was painted by a man named Rudolf Zallinger, who was born in Siberia, moved to the United States, and took up illustration professionally during the Great Depression. If he were around today, Zallinger would probably be working for an animation studio as a storyboard artist. He was a master at setting scenes and incorporating diverse sets of characters, telling grandiose stories with the stroke of his brush. His most famous work is undoubtedly The March of Progress, that often satirized timeline of human evolution in which a knuckle-walking ape gradually morphs into a spear-carrying man. More people have probably come to understand or misunderstand the theory of evolution through that one image than through all of the textbooks, school lectures, and museum exhibits the world over. But before he was painting humans, Zallinger was obsessed with dinosaurs. His mural inside the Great Hall, called The Age of Reptiles, is the crowning achievement of that stage of his career. It's been on U.S. postage stamps, was featured in a Life magazine series, and is either reproduced or plagiarized on all sorts of dinosaur paraphernalia. It's the Mona Lisa of paleontology, surely the single most talked about piece of dinosaur artwork that has ever been created. But really it's more akin to the Bayeux Tapestry, because it tells an epic tale of conquest. It's the saga of how fishy creatures first emerged onto land, colonized a new environment, and diversified into reptiles and amphibians. Then of how these reptiles split off into the mammal and lizard lines, the proto-mammals having their day and the lizards following, eventually producing dinosaurs. As the mural nears its end, some 60 feet and 240 million years from where it started, after a long journey through alien landscapes of primeval, scaly beasts, the painting finally becomes engulfed in dinosaurs. It kind of sneaks up on you as the transition from the lizards and proto-mammals to the dinosaurs unfolds incrementally across the canvas. Now it's dinosaurs everywhere, of all shapes and sizes, some enormous and others blending into the background. Suddenly the mural has taken on the feel of something quite different, of a Soviet propaganda poster with Stalin gesticulating before a crowd of peasants, or one of those hilariously self-aggrandizing frescoes in Saddam's palaces. One glance at the dinosaurs and I feel the power, strength, control, dominance. The dinosaurs were in command, and this was their world. This part of Zallinger's mural beautifully encapsulates what it was like when dinosaurs had ascended to the peak of their evolutionary success. A monstrous brontosaurus lounges in a swamp in the foreground, munching away on the ferns and evergreen trees surrounding the water. Off to the side, a bus-sized Allosaurus rips into a bloodied carcass with its teeth and claws, its massive feet stomping on its prey for a little extra insult. Keeping a safe distance is a peaceful, grazing Stegosaurus, which displays its full arsenal of bony plates and spikes just in case the carnivore has other ideas. Far in the background, where the swamp disappears into a wall of snow-capped mountains, another sauropod uses its long neck to vacuum shrubs off of the ground. Meanwhile, two pterosaurs, those flying reptiles closely related to dinosaurs, often called pterodactyls, chase each other overhead, dipping and diving through the tranquil blue sky. Odds are, this is the type of image that many of us think of when we think of dinosaurs. These are dinosaurs at their pinnacle. Zallinger's mural is not fiction. Like any good art, it takes a few liberties here and there, but it is largely rooted in fact. It's based on those very same dinosaurs that stand in front of it in the Great Hall. Familiar names like Brontosaurus, Stegosaurus, and Allosaurus. These dinosaurs lived during the late Jurassic period, about 150 million years ago. By this time, dinosaurs had already become the dominant force on land. Their victory over the Pseudosuchians was 50 million years in the rearview mirror, and it had been a good 20 million years since some of the first giant long-necked species were splashing through the lagoons of Scotland. Nothing was holding back the dinosaurs anymore. We know a lot about the dinosaurs of the late Jurassic. That's because there are abundant fossils from this time in many parts of the world. It's just one of those quirks of geology. Some time periods are better represented in the fossil record than others. It's usually because more rocks were being formed during that time. Or rocks of that age have better survived the rigors of erosion, flooding, volcanic eruptions, and all of the other forces that conspire to make fossils difficult to find. When it comes to the late Jurassic, we enjoy two lucky breaks. First, there were hugely diverse communities of dinosaurs living alongside rivers, lakes, and seas all around the world, the perfect place to bury fossils in sediments that later turned to rock. Second, these rocks are today exposed in places convenient for paleontologists, in sparsely populated and dry regions of the United States, China, Portugal, and Tanzania, where annoyances like buildings, highways, forests, lakes, rivers, and oceans don't cover up the fossil booty. The most famous late Jurassic dinosaurs, those in Zallinger's mural, come from a thick rock deposit that pokes out all across the western United States. Its technical term is the Morrison Formation, named for a small town in Colorado where there are some beautiful exposures of its colorful mudstones and beige-tinged sandstones. The Morrison Formation is a monster. It can be found in 13 states today, covering nearly 400,000 square miles, a million square kilometers of the American scrublands. It is easily sculpted into low hills and undulating badlands, the sort of classic backdrop you see in Western films. It's also the source rock for some of the country's most important uranium ore deposits. And yes, it's a hotbed of dinosaurs, ones whose uranium-infused bones make Geiger counters sing. I worked in the Morrison Formation for 2 summers as an undergraduate. It's where I cut my teeth excavating dinosaur skeletons. I was apprenticing in the lab of the University of Chicago's Paul Serino, whom we last met leading the expeditions to Argentina that turned up some of the world's very oldest dinosaurs, the Triassic Age, Herrerasaurus, Eoraptor, and Eodromius. But Paul seemed to study everything and do field work everywhere. He had also found bizarre fish-eating and long-necked dinosaurs in Africa, he'd explored China and Australia, and he'd even described important fossils of crocodiles, mammals, and birds. In addition, like any academic paleontologist, Paul also had to spend time in the classroom. Each year he taught a popular undergraduate class called Dinosaur Science, which combined theory with practice. Because you can't find dinosaurs anywhere near Chicago, the class would take a 10-day field trip each summer to Wyoming, where the students had the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to dig dinosaurs with a celebrity scientist. Although at the time I had little prior experience, I was brought on as a teaching assistant, Paul's right-hand man, as we herded the students, a diverse lot from pre-meds to philosophy majors, across the high desert. Paul's field sites were located near the tiny town of Shell, secluded between the Bighorn Mountains to the east and Yellowstone National Park, 100 miles to the west. Only 83 people were counted during the last census. When we were there in 2005 and 2006, the road signs boasted of merely 50 residents. But that's a good thing for paleontologists. The fewer people in the way of the fossils, the better. And although Shell is a forgettable dot on the map, it can rightly stake its claim as one of the world's dinosaur capitals. It is built on the Morrison Formation, surrounded by beautiful hills carved out of muted green, red, and gray rocks bursting with dinosaurs. So many dinosaurs have been found here that it's hard to keep track, but the count is probably well over 100 skeletons by now. As we drove west from Sheridan on a surprisingly treacherous road across the rugged Bighorns, I felt I was on the trail of giants. Some of the biggest dinosaurs of all have been found in the Shell area. Long-necked sauropods like Brontosaurus and Brachiosaurus, and the huge carnivores like Allosaurus that ate them. But I also felt I was walking in the footsteps of another type of giant, the explorers who found the first bones in this area in the late 19th century, the railwaymen and laborers who started a dinosaur rush and seized the moment to reinvent themselves as mercenary fossil collectors on the payrolls of gilded institutions like Yale University. They were a ragtag bunch, Wild West ruffians with cowboy hats, mustaches, and unkempt hair who hacked giant bones out of the ground for months on end and spent their free time raiding one another's sites, constantly feuding and sabotaging and drinking and shooting. But these unlikely characters revealed a prehistoric world that nobody knew existed. The first Morrison fossils were surely noticed by the many Native American tribes scattered across the West, But the first recorded bones were collected by a surveying expedition in 1859. In March 1877, the real fun started. A railroad worker named William Reed was returning home from a successful hunt, rifle and pronghorn antelope carcass in tow, when he noticed some huge bones protruding out of a long ridge called Como Bluff, not too far from the railroad tracks in an anonymous expanse of southeastern Wyoming. He didn't know it, but at the same time, a college student, Oramel Lucas, was finding similar bones a few hundred miles to the south, in Garden Park, Colorado. That same month, a schoolteacher named Arthur Lakes had just found a cache of fossils near Denver. By the end of that March, the fever of discovery was spreading throughout the American West, to even the most remote villages and railway outposts. Like any prospecting rush, the dinosaur frenzy attracted a horde of questionable characters to the Wyoming and Colorado backcountry. Many of these men were grizzled opportunists on one mission, to convert dinosaur bones into cash. It didn't take long for them to realize who was paying top dollar. Two dapper East Coast academics, Edward Drinker Cope of Philadelphia and Othniel Charles Marsh of Yale University, the same men we briefly met two chapters ago, who studied some of the first Triassic dinosaurs found in Western North America. Once chummy, these two scientists had let ego and pride metastasize into a full-on feud, which was so radioactive that they would do anything to one-up each other in an insane battle to see who could name the most new dinosaurs. Cope and Marsh were opportunists, too, and with each letter from a ranch hand or railway porter reporting more new dinosaur bones from the Morrison Badlands, they saw the opportunity they had been craving but had been unable to yet fulfill, a chance to beat the other guy once and for all. And they both went for it. Cope and Marsh treated the West like a battlefield, employing rival teams that often acted more like armies, scooping up fossils wherever they went and sabotaging the other side whenever they could. Loyalties were fluid. Lucas worked for Cope and Lakes teamed up with Marsh. Reed worked for Marsh, but members of his team defected to Cope. Pillaging, poaching, and bribing were the rules of the game. The madness continued for over a decade, and when it was over, it was hard to separate the winners from the losers. On the plus side, the so-called Bone Wars led to the discovery of some of the most celebrated dinosaurs, the ones that roll off the tongue of every schoolchild. Allosaurus, Apatosaurus, Brontosaurus, Ceratosaurus, Diplodocus, Stegosaurus, just to name a few. On the other hand, the mentality of constant warfare caused a lot of sloppiness. Fossils haphazardly excavated and hastily studied, scraps of bone mistakenly christened as new species, different bits of the skeleton of the same dinosaur regarded as belonging to totally different animals. Wars can't last forever, and as the 19th century turned over to the 20th, sanity began to set in. New dinosaurs were still being found throughout the western United States, and most of the country's leading natural history museums and many top universities had crews working somewhere in the Morrison Formation. But the chaos of the dinosaur rush was over. With less turbulence came several major discoveries. A graveyard of over 120 dinosaurs near the Colorado-Utah border, which later became Dinosaur National Monument. A pit with over 10,000 bones, mostly belonging to the super predator Allosaurus, south of Price, Utah, called the Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry. A bone bed in the Oklahoma Panhandle, discovered by a road crew and excavated by a team of laborers who lost their jobs during the Great Depression and were put back to work digging up dinosaurs with money from Roosevelt's New Deal. And the site near Shell that Paul Serino was now working, with the assistance of me and a phalanx of undergraduate laborers paying hefty tuition for the privilege. Paul has discovered his fair share of dinosaur sites around the world, but the quarry near Shell is not one of them. Instead, it was a local rock collector who reported the first bones in the area. In 1932, she mentioned them to Barnum Brown, a New York paleontologist passing through town. We'll meet Brown again in the next chapter, because much earlier in his career, he discovered Tyrannosaurus rex. Brown was intrigued by the rock collector's story and followed her to the lonely ranch of an octogenarian named Barker Howe, surrounded by sage-scented hills, stalked by mountain lions, and abuzz with grazing pronghorns. Brown liked what he saw and stayed the week. What he found was promising enough to convince Sinclair Oil to fund a full-scale expedition in the summer of 1934 to dig up what is now called the Howe Quarry. It turned out to be one of the most fantastic dinosaur excavations of all time. Once Brown's crew started digging, they kept finding skeletons everywhere, piled on top of each other and extending in all directions. More than 20 skeletons and 4,000 bones in all, covering some 3,000 square feet, 280 square meters, approaching the size of a basketball court. There was so much raw fossil material that it took about 6 months of daily work to excavate. The team broke camp only in mid-November after enduring 2 months of heavy snow. The diggers found an entire ecosystem preserved in stone. There were giant long-necked plant eaters like Diplodocus and Barosaurus entangled with sharp-toothed Allosauruses and smaller herbivores that walked on two legs called Camptosaurus. Something horrible had happened here some 155 million years ago. Judging from the contorted angles of their skeletons, the deaths of these animals were neither quick nor painless. Some of the sauropods were found upright, their heavy legs standing tall like columns stuck in the ancient mud. It seems that these dinosaurs survived a flood, but then were mired in the muck when they tried to run away after the waters receded. Brown was delighted. He called the site an absolute knockout dinosaur treasure trove, and gleefully took his haul of dinosaurs back to New York, where they became crown jewels in the collection of the American Museum of Natural History. And then, for many decades, the Howe Quarry lay dormant, until a fossil collector from Switzerland named Kirby Sieber rolled into Wyoming in the late 1980s. Sieber is a commercial paleontologist. He digs up dinosaurs and sells them. It's a thorny issue for many academic paleontologists like me, who see fossils as irreplaceable natural heritage that should be protected in museums, where they can be studied by researchers and enjoyed by the public, not sold off to the highest bidder. But there is a whole spectrum of commercial paleontologists, ranging from gun-toting criminals who illegally export fossils to diligent, conscientious, well-trained collectors whose knowledge and experience rival that of academics. Sieber is in this latter category. In fact, he's the archetype of this kind of collector. He is well-respected by researchers and even founded his own dinosaur museum east of Zurich called the Saurier Museum, which has some of the most remarkable dinosaur exhibits in Europe. Sieber arranged access to the old Howe Quarry, but didn't find many dinosaurs. Brown's team had pretty much cleared them all out. So the Swiss collector began prospecting in the surrounding gullies and hills, looking for new sites. It wasn't long before he found a good one, about 1,000 feet north of the original quarry. His backhoe first revealed some sauropod bones, and then a string of vertebrae from the backbone of a big meat-eating theropod. Sieber followed the spool-shaped bones one by one, and before long it was clear that he had something special. The nearly complete skeleton of an Allosaurus, the top predator of the Morrison Formation ecosystem. It looked to be the single best fossil of this well-known dinosaur that had ever been found, more than 120 years after Marsh first named it during the heat of the Bone Wars. Allosaurus was the butcher of the Jurassic, both figuratively and literally. This fierce predator stalked the Morrison floodplains and riverbanks. Think T-Rex, but a little smaller and lighter, about 2 to 2.5 tons in weight and 30 feet, 9 meters long as an adult, and better equipped for running. But it truly earned the title of butcher, because paleontologists think it used its head like a hatchet to hack its prey to death. Computer models find that the thin teeth of Allosaurus couldn't bite very strongly on their own, but the skull could withstand massive amounts of impact force. We also know that Allosaurus could open its jaws obscenely wide, so we think a hungry Allosaurus would attack with mouth agape and slash down at its prey, slicing through the skin and muscle with its thin but sharp teeth, which were lined up along its jaw like the blades of scissors. Many a Stegosaurus and Brontosaurus probably breathed its last this way. If for some reason the bloodlusting Allosaurus couldn't quite knock off its victim using only its jaws of death, it could always finish the job with a couple of swipes of its clawed, three-fingered arms, which were longer and more versatile than the stubby little forelimbs of T-Rex. Finding such a complete and well-preserved Allosaurus was one of the highlights of Sieber's career, but emotions were about to turn. After the summer's excavation had ended, while Sieber was at a fossil show peddling his wares and the Allosaurus skeleton remained in the ground, an agent from the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, BLM, happened to be flying over that dusty stretch of northern Wyoming near the Howe Quarry. The agent was checking for signs of fire, part of his job monitoring public lands administered by the U.S. government. But as he glided high above the Badlands, he noticed that the dirt roads around the Howe Quarry had been shredded by tire marks. Somebody had been doing some heavy work that summer. That's no problem around the Howe Quarry itself. It's on private land, and Sieber had the permission of the landowner. But the BLM agent wasn't quite sure what was private ground and what was public, which could only be worked on by accredited scientists with BLM permission. So he double-checked and found that Sieber had strayed a few hundred feet into BLM territory. Because Sieber had no right to work there, he could no longer excavate the Allosaurus skeleton. It was probably an honest mistake, but a costly one. The BLM now had a problem. A gorgeous dinosaur skeleton was sitting in the ground, and the people who had found it and begun to excavate it couldn't finish the job. So the agency assembled a crack team led by legendary paleontologist Jack Horner's crew at Montana's Museum of the Rockies. Horner is best known for two things, discovering the first dinosaur nesting sites in the 1970s and being the science advisor for the Jurassic Park films. Under the eye of television cameras and a throng of newspaper reporters, the academics took out the skeleton and trucked it up to Montana to be carefully conserved in the safety of the laboratory. The dinosaur turned out to be more spectacular than Sieber could even have imagined. About 95% of the bones were there, an almost unheard-of number for a large predatory dinosaur. At about 25 feet, 8 meters long, this Allosaurus was only about 60 to 70% grown. It was still a teenager, but it had already lived a tough life. Its body was covered with all types of maladies, broken, infected, and deformed bones that testify to the rough-and-tumble world of the late Jurassic. When even the biggest predators didn't have an easy time hunting behemoths like Diplodocus and Brontosaurus. When the sharpest teeth and claws were no guarantee of surviving a whack from the spiky tail of a Stegosaurus. The Allosaurus was nicknamed Big Al, and it became a celebrity dinosaur. It even had its own television special broadcast internationally by the BBC. But once the buzz died down, there remained a huge hole in the ground that was still full of all kinds of fossils that were buried underneath Big Al. Paul Serino received permission from the BLM to use the site as a field laboratory to teach excavation techniques to his students. And that's why we were taking three big SUVs full of undergraduates there. During that first season in Wyoming in the summer of 2005, I spent many days parked out on the high desert, carefully removing globs of popcorn-textured mudstone to help the team uncover the skeleton of a Camarasaurus. It may not be one of the brand-name dinosaurs, but Camarasaurus is one of the most common species in the Morrison Formation. It is yet another type of sauropod, a close cousin of Brontosaurus.